I will call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order today. Today, we're going to have a legal services oversight review on the report that they've made. So we have Senator Reinbold, Senator Shelley Hughes, Senator Jesse Keel, and myself, Senator Coghill. I think we'll be joined by other senator here shortly, Senator Michicki. My staff, Sean Ayer. This is her first committee hearing, so she's trying to help us out here. We got Nancy Hemingway over here helping us. She will keep me straight in order if I miss something, and Doug Bridges is here at the LIO. And I have from time to time needed some prompting from our recording secretary. So only one item today, ladies and gentlemen, and that is to have the department, our own Ledge Legal, come and give us this oversight report, which I think to me is important. It helps us in a context of a lot of other things that we have to deal with here, and it'll also show us where we have what you might call incongruent parts, right? And so today we have Megan Wallace with us, who is the director, and then we have we'll have Linda Bruce here, and we have Mira Collette. I'm sorry. And you guys, it's always good to get instruction in Sandon Fisher with us, and so thank you very much. With that, there was no intention other than this invited testimony for this, and so Megan, you have the floor.
Thank you. For the record, Megan Wallace, Director of Legal Services. I want to thank the committee for having us today. We're going to go over the oversight report. I can't really take any credit for the oversight report this year. I have a very talented team that works on this report, and I have with me, as the chairman has already indicated, the attorneys who worked in reviewing, summarizing, and providing the recommendations for the oversight report. And I would be remiss not to thank our front office staff, specifically Kevin Gulfson and Tricia Boone, who also worked in preparing this report. It's a task that we prepare all interim long, kind of piece by piece. But let us start by describing kind of why we prepare this oversight report. So AS 2420065A requires Ledge Council to examine administration regulations, opinions of the state and federal courts, and opinions of the Department of Law that rely on the Alaska statutes, and to determine whether or not the courts or agencies are properly implementing the legislative purposes, whether the court has expressed any dissatisfaction with those statutes or with the common law of the state, and generally just to review those opinions and report back to the legislature. So under subsection B, we provide this comprehensive report, which is the oversight report.
So we ask for it.
You ask for it, and you get it. I will note that the administrative procedure review, we no longer review the regs. The legislature in 2018, I believe, repealed the reg commission authority, and so that's no longer a task that Legislative Legal Services is tasked with. So as I described, the oversight report will review the opinions of the Alaska Supreme Court, the Alaska Court of Appeals. We also go through and do a search of the Ninth District and the District of Alaska federal cases to see if they've issued any published opinions that delve into or analyze our state Alaska statutes. And we also go through the formal and informal attorney general opinions that were issued within the year, specifically to identify things of legislative interest. I would say majority of those, especially this year, the legislature was already aware of, and so we didn't have to highlight those in the report. But they're there just to give a full picture of the analysis that has happened. And to give a little bit of background in terms of how we go about that review. So if you already aren't aware or subscribe, the Alaska Supreme Court issues decisions on Fridays. And so those reports or those opinions come out every week. And I assign those out to the attorneys, and they read the Alaska Supreme Court opinions all year round. And we just make notations of whether, yes, we think this should be considered in the oversight report or, you know, maybe. And then in the interim, when we have more time and we're not in session, we go back through those cases, pull out the ones, we prepare summaries, and the office compiles the report that you have with you. So that's why it takes, you know, a couple months to get all that work together. But it is one of our main interim responsibilities that the office has. And so in your report, you will notice that after the cases are summarized, there's a notation in the report. It either indicates that legislative review is not recommended, which means we're just including the case because that case analyzed or interpreted either a constitutional provision or our Alaska statute, and we thought that you should be aware. Or alternatively, there will be a recommendation for legislative review or a qualifier that maybe legislative review is not recommended unless there's something specifically the legislature might want to go back and look at with respect to the decision that was rendered. So what our plan for today was is to go through our 2019 oversight report and highlight for you those cases. There was three cases that we recommended that the legislature take a look at, and then there are about 15 other cases that may be of interest that the legislature may want to go back and review. And so I will turn it over to the attorneys who worked or who read those cases to give you a brief summary. We'll be happy to take questions, but the attorneys that are here are the attorneys that worked on the oversight report. They're not necessarily the subject matter experts of the statute or the subject that was under discussion by the court. So I just ask that you bear that in mind in terms of diving too deep into a subject area that maybe these attorneys don't work on. And
I will echo that, because part of the reason I want to do this is make us aware. And that way, if there was a subject issue that we wanted to delve into, then we could delve into it more deeply outside of this particular meeting. So it wasn't my intention to try to drill down into some of these and renegotiate them or re-litigate them. But there are some that we're going to have to pay attention to, and I think as they're flagged up to us, maybe we can make our individual notes and say, I would like to follow that, and maybe from my committee suggestions will come in. We should probably take a look at it in a different way than from this report. So I will echo that as a chairman as well, and I'll try to manage it that way.
Right. And so Linda Bruce has our first cases that we have recommended for legislative review.
And make sure that microphone is nice and close to you. Only for those who are listening in over the internet. Thank you. Put yourself on the record and let's give us your testimony on this.
For the record, Linda Bruce, Legislative Legal Services. I will be discussing the first eight cases. I believe we have 18 that we're going to be addressing today. I also have the first three, which are all the cases which we've recommended that the legislature take a look at. The first case is State v. Planned Parenthood of the Greater Northwest. This case deals with a statute. In 2014, the legislature enacted AS 4707-068, which redefined which abortions qualify as medically necessary for the purposes of Medicaid funding. The statute specifically prohibited Medicaid payment for abortions unless the abortion services are for a medically necessary abortion or the pregnancy was the result of rape or incest. Subsection B3 of that statute defines a medically necessary abortion as one that, in a physician's objective and reasonable professional judgment, after considering medically relevant factors, must be performed to avoid a threat of serious risk to the life or physical health of a woman from continuation of the woman's pregnancy. Subsection B4 then defined serious risk to the life or physical health. The court determined that the statute and the regulation impose different requirements for Medicaid funding eligibility upon women who choose to have abortions, who terminate their pregnancy, versus women who continue with their pregnancy. And the court therefore held that the statute violated the Alaska Constitution guarantee to equal protection. As provided in the report, we just said that legislative review is recommended to consider amending the statute in light of this decision.
I remember the debate. Senator Reinbold, you had a question?
Thank you. This was a bill that I co-sponsored. It was one of the first pieces of legislation, so of course I find this very challenging can you define equal protection? I mean, how about the protection of the baby?
Well, I think at this point, I just want to have a flag, because that's a question we're going to have to ask ourselves here. How do we deal with this particular statutory provision that has been found unconstitutional? How do we challenge the courts on that? And so their definition is what we have to deal with, not what our reviewers came up with. So
through the chair, that's exactly why I was asking the Constitution's guarantee of equal protection. I said define equal protection. That's exactly where I was going with this.
Well, the court case is what actually brought that out, and that's why I was trying to make sure the reviewer didn't have to review the whole court case, because I just wanted it flagged that we're going to have to look into this. I think that's pretty much what I asked for this review to come up with. But I think you're exactly right. It hits my hot button,
mm-hmm,
and
too.
So, and I think as we go through it, it's a public debate that we need to get into. I just want to flag that our Supreme Court and us had a disagreement. They said there was an equal protection problem. We're going to have to deal with it. So, if you want to deal with it, I'll be glad to join you, Senator. And just let you know that we've been joined by Senator Machicki. Welcome, Senator Machicki. We got into the first hot topic of the day, and that is recommendations for legislative review. We're on page 4 of that particular thing. And the first hot button we talked about was Planned Parenthood versus the state on equal protection issues of abortion. imagine us hitting a hot button right off the bat. On page 4, mm-hmm. And what I've done is I've asked our alleged legal team, we don't necessarily need to argue the issue, and that's what I was just talking with Senator Reinbold about. We want the review to come forward and say, okay, here are some places where the courts handled our statute in a certain way. How are you going to deal with it, basically? All right. Please continue. Yes, ma'am. Senator Hughes.
And I think it is appropriate that this one was flagged, Mr. Chair, and there is a constitutional amendment out there that would address this issue, SJR 13.
Yeah, it might bring that to light. Please continue.
For the record, Linda Bruce, Legislative Legal Services. The next case that we are discussing is Doe v. State. This is the case where the court considered whether the Alaska Sexual Offender Registration Act violated due process by requiring all sex offenders to register without providing a procedure for them to establish their non-dangerousness. Under the act, all sex offenders must register at least every year for 15 years. However, repeat offenders or offenders guilty of an aggravated offense must register quarterly for life. So first, the court concluded that Alaska is not barred by lack of jurisdiction from requiring out-of-state offenders who are present in Alaska from registering with the act, so they determined that they do have to register. Next, the court concluded that the act violated due process, however, because there a person placed on the registry for life has a right to privacy in this information. The court agreed with the state that there was a compelling state interest in protecting the public from sex offenders. However, the court determined that the act did not provide the least restrictive means for for achieving this goal. So the court concluded that the defect may be cured by providing a procedure for offenders to establish their non-dangerousness, for example, through a hearing. The court specifically said that they were not invalidating the act because it serves very obvious legitimate purposes. So they just required, in that case, that the registrant had to be given an opportunity for a hearing to establish that he was no longer a danger to the public.
So just for what it's worth, we do have a bill in State Affairs on this very issue. Senator Keel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Bruce, did the decision talk about time frames, or is it one hearing? Is it multiple hearings?
The decision, or through the chair, Senator Keel, the decision did not address time frames. It did not address if multiple hearings are needed. It appears from the decision that just one hearing is needed, but it didn't say if you need to be allowed to do a hearing every 5 years or something to that effect. I think the idea is that it's left to the legislature.
So just for what it's worth, we will have our chance in this committee to deal with that, and we will do a court review, and we'll also look at the proposed, actually from the governor's office, a proposed solution that once again will be in our hands to come up with a conclusion on. So this will, Senator Reinbold.
Thank you. So it would be a little bit helpful. I don't know if you're in a position to do this, but the bill number in the year that it passed, do you have that? For example, for this sex registry, does this have to do with House Bill 49, or is this a different bill?
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, this does not have to do with House Bill 49. The sex offender registry, I believe, was passed in 1994. It has been amended multiple times since then, but I do not have the original bill number.
There is something that I think will be helpful to you and to all of us, and that is when we look at our statute, if you look at the statute that is operative here under the Title 18 and 12, you'll have footnotes, and that will give the court decision. And when we get to have this issue before us, those will come to bear. So,
through the chair.
Senator Reinbold.
Thank you. So basically, I mean, if it's been 1994, it's 2020. So that's 26 years. And all of a sudden, why is it coming to light right now then?
It was the one particular court complaint from somebody that came from out of state. And we'll review that case in front of us. You're doing exactly what we need to do, and ask why, but not now. This is just the review, but that's why these are in front of us. I wanted to flag these as issues that we should deal with, but I didn't want to deal with them right now. So I want to bring it to light, and you're doing exactly what I was doing the other day, reading these things, thinking, oh, man, and I never got to the third one. So, and I want to get to the completion of this, Senator Reinbold.
And through the chair?
through the chair.
Absolutely. I get it. And I was actually stressing over this meeting because I knew it was going to be a tough meeting, to go through this. I actually think this is going to be one of the harder. You said it's going to be exciting. I said it's going to be really tough. but I think that we did deal with a sex registry, and we did talk about this, I don't know how many days, in Judiciary and State Affairs last year. And that's why it's just interesting to me that it triggers, because this is a public safety issue, and I'm really looking forward to drilling deeper.
So the courts responded to something that we had done. Somebody had a complaint. The courts made a decision that now we're going to have to respond to. I anticipate responding to it in this committee, just to let you know. Senator Keel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When we do come back to this, I just found my notes, Ms. Bruce, and it'd be good to talk a little further about the notion of rehearing. I have a note that they talked about an applicant being permitted to file a new complaint to get off the registry. So let's follow up on that.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Matucci.
Wasn't here at the beginning. I had Goldman Sachs in my office on a particular complaint that I have about them, but I shouldn't say that on the record. what are we doing today? We're simply reviewing the report, and we have a slide deck that matches the report for recommendations for legislative review. So they're just kind of giving us a status of the cases.
My whole intention was, and as you can see, each of the lawyers here have eight portions that they expect that we should probably bring up for review. And if we debated each one of them, we'd only get one or two of them, as you can see. So I was trying to keep it corralled and just bring up the issue so that it flags us as something that we need to consider. And I will tell you when there's a bill already being involved in considering it, and or we need to do further work in the Judiciary Committee on. So that was the intent.
Very, very briefly, it's hard not to get sucked in, but now that I understand, we spend a lot of time and sometimes become very passionate about some of these causes, so it's hard to just say, okay, we'll keep it at status, I'm good to go.
Well, and each one of these bring their own legal and emotional debate with them, believe me. I mean, they just do. They just, because they're hard decisions and they're policies that we're going to have to come back and revisit. So please continue.
Again, for the record, Linda Bruce with Legislative Legal Services. Just to wrap up on the Doe case, we did recommend legislative review to consider the Alaska Sexual Offender Registration Act in light of this decision. As Chair Coghill pointed out, the governor has introduced legislation dealing with this issue relating to sex offender registration. The bill numbers for that are House Bill 228 and Senate Bill 168. The next case is Hamburg v. State, and this does have to do with House Bill 49 from last year. And the court in this case from 2018 considered the pre-2018 version of Alaska Statute 12.30.011D2, which provided that when a defendant is charged with certain types of offenses, there's a rebuttable presumption that no condition of bail will guarantee the defendant's appearance at future court hearings and the safety of the public. The court held that the pre-2018 version of the statute, creating a presumption that a defendant charged with certain offenses should not be released on bail, was unconstitutional under Article 1, Section 11 of the Alaska Constitution. We recommended legislative review because this very similar language was reenacted in House Bill 49, so it's now back in statute.
So challengeable is what you're saying?
Correct, yes.
Yeah, right, so it's something that we should look at. Right. Mm-hmm.
The next case is State v. Thompson. In this case, a defendant was convicted of multiple counts of first degree and second degree sexual abuse of a minor. The disagreement here was whether or not there should be separate convictions or separate convictions could be imposed for sexual penetration with different objects or body parts, regardless of the time period of the assault. The defendant argued that these separate convictions should be merged into one conviction. The Alaska Supreme Court first determined that the same rules for merger apply to both sexual abuse of a minor and sexual assault convictions. Next, the court considered the constitutional protections against double jeopardy and the legislative intent of the sexual assault and sexual abuse of a minor statutes, and concluded that a separate act of penetration occurs, or separate act of penetration occurs each time, the penetrated orifice or penetrating object or body part changes. So each of these can support separate convictions. And our recommendation is that its legislative review is not recommended unless the legislature does not want to allow separate convictions for each distinct act of non-consensual sexual penetration when either the penetrating object or body part or the penetrated orifice has changed. And we stated that legislative review is not recommended because generally it seems like the court followed legislative intent and the plain language of the statutes, but just flagging it for your consideration in case there is something there that you want to look at. Next is Nelson v.
Question, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Machicki on that.
The court ultimately found that the charges not being merged was appropriate. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
And I think from the discussion that I remember, that was our intent.
The next case is Nelson v. State, and this case dealt with rules of professional conduct. A defendant in this case alleged ineffective assistance of counsel from his public defender. At the defendant's sentencing hearing, the defendant was represented by another public defender from the same public defender agency. The Superior Court, at that time, the defendant said that he shouldn't have a public defender from the same office, that there was a conflict. The Superior Court agreed, but only appointed new counsel for any appellate or post-conviction relief proceedings and proceeded to sentence the defendant. On appeal, the Alaska Supreme Court adopted a per se rule under which a mere allegation of ineffective assistance of counsel is enough to create a conflict of interest that would disqualify the public defender. So the court ultimately held that if a public defender has a conflict of interest that disqualifies the public defender from representing a defendant when the defendant raises an ineffective assistance of counsel claim against another public defender in the same office, then no public defender within that office can represent that defendant. And the court also held that a defendant is entitled to conflict counsel immediately after raising the ineffective assistance of counsel claim in the context of an attempt to withdraw a plea, as the defendant did in this circumstance. So we stated that legislative review is not recommended unless the legislature wants a public defender's conflict to only be imputed to others in the same office on a case-by-case basis. Some states, I believe, do operate in this manner.
Senator Reinbold?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Basically, I'm trying to figure out how do these correlate with one another, because I can find some of the cases and then you're jumping around. I'm trying to put notes on
both. All right, so I see Megan Wallace coming up. So, Megan, you can help us out there.
For the record, Megan Wallace, Legal Services Director. Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, I forgot to mention that. So because we have multiple drafters of this report, I tried to organize our synopsis based on the cases that Linda reviewed and then our other attorneys. Mm-hmm. And so in your slides, I have designated the page number on the report that she's discussing. So the Nelson v. State on the slide number 6 says page 17.
Thank you.
If you turn to page 17 in your report, you can follow along. And I put page numbers because we are jumping around and I want folks to be able to follow along in the report.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Reinbold.
Extremely helpful. Thank you.
A simple answer, but pretty important for us. Thank you.
Through the chair, it saves us from switching out seats up here, you know, every other case. So.
Thank you. All right, continue.
For the record, Linda Bruce, Legislative Legal Services, and you will be seeing me again after my portion is done because I have the privilege of discussing the delayed effective dates as well. So I'll be back again, but that's why that got broken up that way. The next case is Weston v. AK Happy Time. In this case, a woman slipped and fell in a hotel parking lot. When the woman sued the hotel sought to argued that only the amount Medicare actually paid for her medical expenses was relevant and admissible, and that she should not be allowed to introduce her original medical bills. The court in this case said that at trial, in front of the fact finder, the woman would be allowed to introduce her original medical bills as evidence. However, under Alaska Statute 0917070, after the judgment, the defendant could introduce evidence to the court for a possible reduction of the claim. In this case, legislative review is not recommended unless the legislature wants to limit the evidence introduced at trial to the amount actually paid rather than the amount of the original medical bills. Next is Keaton 3 v. State. under this case, under Alaska Statute 09.55.440A, pardon me, when DOT files a taking, the department has to deposit with the court the amount that the department estimates is the appropriate amount of compensation for the taking. A landowner can then, if they don't think that that's a correct amount, they can pursue that and try to get a court to determine that the amount of the taking is greater. If the landowner succeeds in that, then there's a statute, again, AS 0955440, that allows any difference between the amount awarded and the amount that DOT placed in, that the DOT originally placed with the court, to be charged an interest rate of 10.5% annually. So in this case, the landowner argued that the amount finally awarded should also include attorney's fees and costs, and the court disagreed and held that for purposes of this prejudgment interest under the statute, that the amount finally awarded does not include attorney's fees and costs. It's just the fair value of the land. So they still get attorney's fees and costs, and I believe that the interest rate for that is 4.5%. So it's really just if this increased interest rate applies. Under this case, legislative review is not recommended unless the legislature wants to include attorney's fees and costs in the amount finally awarded for purposes of awards of prejudgment interest under the statute. So only one more case from me, and then you can hear from someone else. The next case is RC v. State. Under this case, the court considered two different statutes. One is AS 12.55.045, which prohibits trial courts from considering a criminal defendant's ability to pay when determining the amount of restitution in a criminal case. However, in this case, a juvenile argued that the trial court erred in failing to consider the juvenile's ability to pay when it ordered the restitution amount. On appeal, the court noted that there's no similar provision to that criminal provision within the juvenile delinquency proceeding statutes under 4712. Instead, 4712.120b4 provides that a court shall order a minor and the minor's parents to make suitable restitution. The court noted that the legislature, this has come before the legislature multiple times in one context or another, and the legislature has chosen not to amend the juvenile statutes to have a similar language to the criminal provision, and ultimately held that trial courts are not prohibited from considering a juvenile's ability to pay when setting restitution amounts in juvenile delinquency cases. In this case, legislative review is not recommended unless the legislature does not want a court to consider a minor's ability to pay restitution in juvenile delinquency cases, essentially if you want to adopt similar language to the criminal provision for juveniles.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I appreciate it. And I'm sorry, you got to go first, so we had to settle all the rules down while you get started. So.
And I should ask before I leave, are there any questions on anything?
I think we all have plenty of questions.
Exactly. I'm not saying no.
But under this review, I think what you're going to do is create a catalog of things that we need to look at. So, but that was the whole intent of this, is to take a good look at what's come our way, what the courts have done, and even our own effective dates, how we might handle some of those things. So put yourself on the record.
Sir, for the record, Sandon Fisher with Legal Services. The first case that I have is Thompson versus Hebdon. This case challenged Alaska's campaign contribution limits on the grounds that they violate the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, specifically a $500 annual limit on a contribution from an individual to a political candidate, $500 limit on a contribution from an individual to a non-political party group, the annual limits on the amount a non-political party group can contribute to a candidate, and the annual aggregate limit that a political candidate may accept from a non-resident of the state were challenged. The court, which is the Ninth Circuit in this case, held that the first three campaign contribution limits were constitutional because they furthered an important state interest and were narrowly tailored to that interest. The court held that the fourth campaign contribution limit was unconstitutional, the fourth limit being limits on contributions from non-residents of the state. Generally, a state can impose contribution limits in order to further the important state interest. Supreme Court case law has said that the important state interest is preventing quid pro quo corruption, so that's the interest that the state has an interest, or that's what the state has an interest in preventing. And the contribution limit will be upheld if the limit is closely drawn to furthering that important state interest. In this case, the court noted that the state didn't show why early contributions from a non-resident were not corrupting, but then later contributions that were above the limit somehow became corrupting. And for that reason, the court held that the limit on non-resident contributions was unconstitutional and did not further an important state interest.
We are interested. And so it looks like you've recommended review on this particular one.
Yes, sir. So because the court found that this fourth campaign contribution limit was unconstitutional, we recommend review. The court basically said the statute is unconstitutional, unenforceable, and
so if you're all flagging issues, this might be one that will come up. I have not seen a statutory provision brought forward at this point yet, but
correct. And those contribution limits are in AS 1513-070 and 1513-072 primarily.
Senator Keel?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think there's one in the other body.
Is there?
The proposal.
Okay. All right. Okay. Okay, Sam.
Moving on to the next case. This is State versus Tofologo. In this case, a man accidentally killed his roommate with a knife while demonstrating martial art rules, martial art moves. He pled guilty to criminally negligent homicide and agreed that the statutory aggravator in AS 1255-155C18 Cap A applied. This aggravator allows for sentencing above the upper range if a felony was committed against a spouse, a former spouse, or a member of a social unit made up of those living in the same dwelling as the defendant. On appeal, the defendant argued that the aggravator shouldn't apply to his case because the legislature intended the statute to apply to domestic violence situations, and this wasn't domestic violence. The Court of Appeals agreed with the defendant, and then on appeal from the Court of Appeals, the Supreme Court reversed the Court of Appeals and concluded that the plain language of the statute applies to roommate situations, specifically a member of a social unit made up of those living in the same dwelling as the defendant. So legislative review is recommended if the Supreme Court's interpretation of the aggravator is not consistent with the legislature's intent. Basically, did the legislature intend that this aggravator should only apply to domestic violence situations?
Thank you.
The next case I have is Michael V. Brown. This case involves a child whose parents separated in the lower 48. The father moved to New York, the mother moved to Alaska. In 2016, the mother went to, I believe, Arizona to go into rehab. From that time forward, the minor child stayed with his maternal grandparents in Alaska in 2016. In 2017, the grandparents filed a petition to be appointed as the child's legal guardian, and the father in New York opposed the petition. Under AS 1326-132, the court may appoint a guardian for a minor if all the parental rights of custody have been terminated or suspended by circumstances or a prior court order. Here, the Supreme Court held that the proper order of inquiry, the proper order of inquiry is to first apply the biological parent preference, which is a presumption that the parent should have custody of the child. That preference can be overcome only if the parent's rights have been terminated or suspended by circumstances or by a court order. In this guardianship situation, the court said that suspended by circumstances means a set of circumstances which deprives the parent of the ability to accept the rights and responsibilities of parenthood. If the court can't overcome this first hurdle, we don't go any further, and the parent is entitled to their biological preference. If there is a set of circumstances that deprives the parent of the ability to accept the rights and responsibility of parenthood, then the court considers the best interest of the child in determining who to appoint as the guardians. So here, the best interest of the child is not the first order of the court's inquiry in a guardianship dispute between a non-parent and a parent. So legislative review is recommended if the legislature wishes to clarify or change the standard for appointing a non-parent as the guardian of a minor.
Tough case.
Sir? The next case I have begins on page 29 of the report, Communi. I apologize for butchering the pronunciation there. This case involves the relationship between a creditor and the owners of a joint checking account. In this case, a father and son opened a joint checking account. Almost all of the money was traceable to the son. Almost all the money was placed in the account by the son. A creditor of the father levied against the account and collected about $90,000 from the account. The son joined the action that the creditor had initiated against the father, claiming that he was the equitable owner of the funds and the funds should be returned to him. At issue in this case is AS 1333-211A, which provides that unless there is clear and convincing evidence of a different intent, an account belongs to the parties in proportion to their net contributions of each. Here, the Supreme Court held that when there's a dispute between a creditor and a joint account owner, the court must first apply the presumption of 1333-211 and calculate the net contributions of the owners to determine the amount of funds subject to levy, and then the creditor can rebut the statutory presumption by providing evidence of some intent to the contrary with respect to ownership of the account. In this case, legislative review is not recommended unless the legislature would like to adjust the relationship between creditors and joint account owners. And it's important to note here that this statute, the court made sure to mention, applies only to disputes between creditors and joint account owners. It wouldn't necessarily apply to a dispute between the owners of a joint account over the ownership of the funds.
Sounds like it worked the way it's supposed to. That's what it sounds like to me.
Moving on to the next case is Morrison versus Alaska Interstate Construction. In this case, a worker injured his knee working for an employer in 2004. The employer paid all the workers' comp claims for the injury. The worker returned to work for a different employer and in 2014 injured his knee again. The new employer disputed liability and the worker then filed a claim against Interstate, which was a new employer. The question here being, should the old or the new employer be liable for the workers' comp claim, be responsible for paying that? This case involves the last injurious exposure rule, which applies when successive injuries with different employers each contribute to a worker's needs for medical care. Prior to 2005, the rule imposed full liability on the employer at the time of the most recent injury that bore a causal relationship to the disability. However, in 2005, the legislature amended AS 2330-010, which deals with which claims are compensable, to provide that compensation benefits are available if the employment is the substantial cause in the need for treatment. This change now requires the Workers' Compensation Appeals Board to look at the different causes of need for medical treatment and determine which of those causes is the most substantial. The court held that this statutory change went back to amend the last injurious exposure rule instead of looking to the person who was the employer at the time that there was the last injury that related to the disability. Now the board looks to which injury was the substantial cause of this disability, and the board can then impose liability on the current employer or an earlier employer rather than just going back to the most recent injury.
So that just gives them proportional, they have to decide what is proportionally accurate in this particular case.
Chair Cockle, not necessarily. The court noted that the board has to pick between one or the other, who's ever the most responsible pays in full, and specifically noted that the statute does not apply for apportionment.
Okay, right.
So legislative review is not recommended unless the legislature wishes to change this rule, and you know, apportionment would be one thing to consider. And then finally, I have in the matter of page M, and that's on page 41 of your report, the red book. In this case, a psychologist petitioned to have a patient involuntarily hospitalized. A hearing was held and only the psychologist testified. Based on the psychologist's testimony, the court granted the petition for involuntary hospitalization. The patient was hospitalized under 4730-700, which allows for involuntary hospitalization upon the petition of any adult. This is less of an emergency statute. We have 4737-05, which allows a peace officer or licensed doctor, psychologist to swear an affidavit and have somebody brought immediately, taken in immediately. 4730-700 allows for involuntary hospitalization after a judge issues an order to that effect. Here, the judge under 4730-700 must immediately conduct a screening investigation of the person that's alleged to be mentally ill or direct a local health professional to do so. And here, the court merely clarified that the screening must include a post-petition, but before the judge issues the hospitalization order, interview of the person making the allegation, of significant witnesses, and if reasonably possible, the respondent or person alleged to have a mental illness that needs involuntary hospitalization. In this case, legislative review is not recommended unless the legislature intends that a screening should be conducted in a manner other than set out by the court in this case.
Sounds like to me they found an artful solution.
Yes, sir. Those are the cases that I have for you today. I'm happy to take any questions if there's anything I can be useful with before I sit down.
Thank you very much, Sandin. And we're moving right along. This is good. And we're getting exactly what we wanted because you're going to pique the interest of a lot of us in almost every arena on this. So put yourself on a record and give us your part.
Mira Coet, Legislative Legal Services. So my first case is the last one on this page, on the slide, and it's Anderson v. State. In this case, the Court of Appeals had to interpret an exception to the marital privileges. The marital privileges are found in Alaska Evidence Rule 505. Rule 505A is specifically the spousal immunity privilege, and that was the one at issue in this case. That rule provides that a married person has a privilege not to be called as a witness when their spouse is charged with a crime. However, there are several exceptions to this privilege where the spouse can be compelled to testify. So at issue in this case was the exception for cases where the spouse is charged with a crime of domestic violence as defined in AS 1866-990. And that statute is the definition section for the chapter on domestic violence and sexual assault in Title 18. And under that statute, in paragraph 3, a crime of domestic violence includes any crime against a person under AS 1141 that is committed by one household member against another household member. And AS 1141 is the chapter on offenses against the person. So under AS 1866-995, which is another definition, the term household member includes adults or minors who are dating or who have dated, and adults or minors who are engaged in or who have engaged in a sexual relationship. So in this case, a high school music teacher was charged with multiple counts of sexual abuse of a minor based on allegations of repeated sexual encounters with a 15-year-old student. So the teacher's wife asserted her spousal immunity privilege to not testify against her husband. And the Court of Appeals concluded that the student was a household member under the statutory definition because the student and teacher dated and were engaged in a sexual relationship. And the court made this finding based on the student's grand jury testimony because the student viewed her sexual relationship with the teacher as consensual and believed they were dating despite her inability to legally consent to the sexual conduct. So the court ruled that the crime of domestic violence exception to the spousal immunity privilege applied and the defendant's wife could be compelled to testify. So in this case, we recommended that the legislature may want to review this case to consider clarifying the term household member if the court's interpretation is inconsistent with the legislature's intent, or to consider adding a specific exception to the marital privileges for a crime against any child, regardless of the child's relation to either spouse, which the court noted that many other jurisdictions have done.
So the court actually gave us the hint on a fix. basis.
Yes. The court noted that it was trying to honor the legislature's intent to broaden who may be considered as a victim of domestic violence, but they did note that this case might be easier to resolve in another jurisdiction where they have this specific exception for a crime against any child.
So we will be dealing with sexual assault issues, so maybe in Title 18 we will see a Title 18 come through here. So kind of keep that in mind. Senator Reinbold.
And Mr. Chairman, if we can also discuss when we have this hearing marital privilege, I just find it astonishing, you know, that a teacher's wife wouldn't want to testify. I mean, I want to go over this marital privilege rule. I'm just like shocked right now that this even is there, because we have got some of the highest rates, as everybody knows, of sexual assault and domestic violence towards children. And I mean, if we can work on that and require testimony, I think that would be really helpful.
What we find in many court cases is astonishing facts. Some of it is how people act and how the rule of law intersects with that action. So that's why we have a legislature to continually review and rethink some of these things. And I think you're exactly right. Who would have contemplated that kind of a reaction? I mean, but here we are. So I think you're right. Yeah. Well, this should be flagged. Please continue. Thank you, Mira.
All right, on the next slide, the first case is Alaska Spine v. Matsu Valley Medical Center. So in this case, the Alaska Supreme Court interpreted the meaning of the term same community within the context of AS 1807031. And that statute requires a healthcare facility to obtain a certificate of need from the Department of Health and Social Services before beginning construction that will exceed $1 million. And under subsection C of that statute, the department may grant an exemption from the certificate of need requirement to an existing ambulatory surgery facility that plans to relocate within the same community as long as the facility does not increase the services it offers. So the statute does not define the term same community, which is why the court was tasked with interpreting that term. So in this case, the department granted an exemption to Alaska Spine Center, an Anchorage facility that sought to relocate to Wasilla after determining that Anchorage and Wasilla are within the same service area and therefore within the same community. The Alaska Supreme Court concluded that neither the plain language of the statute nor the legislative history supported the department's determination that Anchorage and Wasilla are in the same community. And the court noted that Anchorage and Wasilla are part of distinct local governments, are located 44 miles apart, have separate school districts, police forces, and elected officials, have independent hospitals, and have no tax base overlap. The court also noted that the term service area, which is defined in the department's regulations as the geographic area to be served by the proposed activity, including the community where the proposed activity will be located, is clearly broader than the term community, and the terms therefore cannot be synonymous. So in this case, we recommended that the legislature may want to review this case to consider defining the term same community.
But I would say at this point, I think the court got pretty close to where we would have gotten. So,
yes. So something to note is the court did make that decision, but they didn't actually define the term. So there could be future litigation if there's another.
Got a notation on that. Yes. Thanks, Mira. Please continue.
All right. So the next case, Warnk Green v. ProWest Contractors, LLC. So in this case, the Alaska Supreme Court considered whether under AS 2330128, the Alaska Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission can only reconsider its final decisions. That statute describes the appeal proceedings of the Alaska Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission. In this case, a party asked the commission to reconsider its decision regarding attorney fees, and the commission denied the request, stating that under the statute, it is only authorized to reconsider its final decision on the merits of the appeal. The Alaska Supreme Court noted that AS 2330128F is silent about reconsideration of any decisions other than a final decision on appeal, which is described in subsection E. However, the court considered subsection D of that section, which authorizes the commission to affirm, reverse, or modify a decision or order upon review and issue other orders as appropriate. So the court reasoned that subsection D gives the commission broad authority to reconsider its non-final decisions, and that doing so is a necessary part of adjudication and advances the legislative intent to give individuals seeking review of board decisions the same procedural rights that they would otherwise receive in superior court. So the court held that the commission has authority to reconsider its non-final decisions because that authority is necessarily incident to its authority to issue other orders as appropriate under the statute. And in this,
just what it's worth, we do have a bill before the legislature right now dealing with the appeals commission, and a question on whether we should keep the commission or go to the superior court. Senator Reinbold.
And that's, Mr. Chairman, exactly what I was saying. I am a skeptic with that bill. I just have not been convinced. And when I see things like this, it makes me think, why in the world are we getting rid of it?
Yep. Now, I think that's going to be part of the discussion at this point. So I just wanted to bring before this committee, they can do the adjudication, but there is a question, do we want to continue doing that the way? And so thank you.
And in this case, we recommended that the legislature may want to review this case if the legislature did not intend for the commission to have authority to reconsider its non-final decisions. And the next case is Black v. Whitestone Estates Condo Homeowners Association. In this case, the Alaska Supreme Court considered AS 3408-470H, which provides that a condo association shall furnish to a unit owner a statement setting out the amount of unpaid assessments against the unit upon request, and that the statement is then binding on the association, the executive board, and the unit owner. The court considered whether the statute relieves the unit owner of the obligation to pay an assessment that is omitted from the statement when the owner has actual knowledge of the assessment. In this case, a condo owner couple requested a statement of unpaid assessments and then argued that they were not obligated to pay a special assessment because it was omitted from the statement. The Alaska Supreme Court noted that the legislative history of AS 3408-470H showed an intent to protect unit owners by ensuring they could readily obtain information about their liability and preventing associations from collecting assessments that the owners have no knowledge about. So the court reasoned that when an owner has actual knowledge of an assessment, the protection provided by the statute is unnecessary, and it would be contrary to the statute's purpose to allow a unit owner who knows about an assessment to use its omission from a statement as a means to relieve themselves of the obligation to pay it. So we recommended that the legislature may want to review this case if the legislature intends for the statute to relieve a unit owner of the obligation to pay an assessment that is omitted from a statement, even if the owner has no, or even if the owner has actual knowledge of the statement. Excuse me.
Probably not going to happen. Although we'll say this, it just reminds us how important when we're running pages and pages of law under our nose, how these things become significant in these contests. So, yes. Senator Reinbold.
Can I just ask, it's a little bit coloring out of the lines, but I have a homeowners association right now, a condo association that got tremendously damaged by the earthquake, and like people are losing, a lot of the owners are losing their condos right now because of earthquake damage. It's too significant, older couples to pay for the damage. So I guess, would you be the person that I would talk to about issues around this issue?
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, I do not believe I am that person.
Megan may come to, and yes, if you were a slalom skier, you just went past the flag.
For the record, Megan Wallace, Director of Legal Services. Senator Reinbold, I think that probably Terry Bannister would be the one to contact. She does a lot of those kinds of issues. If not, we can make sure we get somebody to answer those questions.
Thank you.
Right, thank you. All right, please continue.
All right, for the record again, Mira Coet, Legislative Legal Services. So the last case on this slide, Adkins v. Collins. In this case, the Alaska Supreme Court considered how full reasonable attorney fees should be calculated under Alaska's Unfair Trade Practices and Consumer Protection Act, and whether the calculation may be based on a contingency fee agreement. The Unfair Trade Practices and Consumer Protection Act is codified in AS 4550, and under AS 4550-537A, a prevailing plaintiff is entitled to full reasonable attorney fees, which is not defined in the statute. in determining the amount of attorney fees, the Superior Court concluded that full reasonable attorney fees under the statute could be defined by the contingency fee agreement executed by the plaintiff and his counsel. The Alaska Supreme Court held that Alaska courts should instead employ the modified lodestar method in calculating full reasonable attorney fees under this statute. And under that method, a court first determines the baseline amount by multiplying the reasonable number of hours worked by a reasonable hourly rate, and then the court may consider a variety of factors to determine whether to adjust that amount. The court therefore concluded that the Superior Court's calculation of attorney's fees based on the contingency fee agreement did not constitute full reasonable attorney fees under the statute. And we recommended that the legislature may want to review this case if the court's method of calculating attorney's fees is inconsistent with the legislature's intent.
Wow. It sounds like they got it right, but maybe somebody might want to pick that up.
I have a tiny question.
A ton of questions?
A tiny question.
Oh, I was going to say, I was going to...
But it's a packed one.
Say no, but no, I wouldn't stop you from asking a question. Senator Reinbold.
Is there anybody who regulates... I mean, when you say reasonable attorney fees, I'm like, gosh, every attorney I go to, it's like huge fees. I don't consider any of them reasonable. So is there any authority that regulates legal fees? Speaking to lawyers, I know who I'm talking to.
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, so the rules of professional conduct would have a rule about what reasonable attorney fees are. The issue is that here the term was just used in the statute with no explanation of what that term means or how to define it. So the court was forced to look to other jurisdictions to see how that was handled under similar consumer protection acts.
And it might be worth noting that there are a couple of places where we probably have issues like that, but it's good to flag, but it sounded like they found a methodology that was reasonable. Senator Keel?
Oh, I'm just dying to know how the baseline amount of attorney's fees got named the lodestar.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I did look into that and could not find an explanation.
Someone with delusions of grandeur.
Mira, thank you very much. We're going to go now to delayed repeals, enactments, or amendments, and we'll have Linda coming back to us. And so you get to put us to sleep on this one a little bit. However, it'll be important for us to note that these do have some significant impact. So please.
Linda Bruce, Legislative Legal Services. I'd point out these are on page 10 of the slides and page 1 of the, there's more information with the actual statutes listed on page 1 of the report in the red book if you want to follow along there. So I compiled this year the delayed amendments and repeals that take effect between February 29th, 2020 and March 1st of 2021. The first repeal that I'll talk about is from, that was enacted in 2008, and it's for the Capstone Avionics Revolving Loan Fund. This fund and program will be repealed on July 1st, 2020. The program allows the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development to make loans for the purchase and installation of Capstone avionics equipment to the owner of an aircraft that logs a substantial percentage of flight hours in the state. And I had to look up as well what Capstone avionics equipment is because I wasn't quite sure. And it's a program to improve tracking and safety on planes. It allows for pilots on their planes to have a moving map video display screen with additional information and allows air traffic control to know exactly where a plane goes down and the precise location of a downed aircraft. So that will be repealed on July 1st, 2020. I'd also like to note that the governor's proposed budget this year includes an appropriation of the balance of that fund on June 30th before the fund is repealed to go to the Department of Commerce for the Alaska Development Team, and it's just a little bit less than $3 million. If the money in the fund is not appropriated this year and the fund is repealed on July 1st, as was provided in 2008, then that money will lapse into the general fund.
And I remember a little bit of this discussion. We had so many aircraft incidents that we did whatever we could to up the level of tracking and in integrity in flying. And I don't think those days have gone away, but this will be a question before the legislature, probably. So thank you.
The next group of statutes that are being repealed are from 2013. It's the Alaska and Gas Competitiveness Review Board. These statutes will be repealed on February 28th, 2021, so in just about a year. The Oil and Gas Competitiveness Review Board primarily collects and reviews information related to oil and gas in the state and makes recommendations to the legislature. The board's final written findings and recommendations to the legislature are due around January 31st, 2021. In 2014, we have these tax credits and indirect expenditures that were enacted in, or pardon, that were provided to be repealed. The first one is Alaska Statute 4375035. It's the Salmon and Herring Product Development Tax, which will be repealed December 31st, 2020. Alaska Statute 4375130F. is also repealed on that same date, December 31st, 2020, and that's a statute directly relating to the first statute I just mentioned. It's worth noting that Senate Bill 130, which is currently, I believe, in front of Senate Resources, extends these provisions and repeals them on January 1st, 2026. So if you're interested in these statutes, there's currently a bill going through the process. Two additional statutes were repealed in 2014. There's Alaska Statute 4377040, which allows a taxpayer who harvests a fishery resource under the provisions of a community development quota to claim a credit for certain approved contributions to a nonprofit corporation, and that's repealed December 31st, 2020. And then the last statute from that year is 4377050B, is amended on December 31st, 2020, to remove a reference to the previous statute. Moving on, in 2015, there was some provisions related to school bond debt reimbursement. These provisions restrict bond debt reimbursement applied for school bonds by a municipality between January 1st, 2015 and July 1st, 2020. These are currently scheduled to be repealed July 1st, 2020. There is a bill, House Bill 106, currently going through the process. It's in Senate Finance, and it's to extend these provisions to July 1st, 2025.
Senator Reinbold.
It's really quick. you said on laws enacted in 2014, this is, well, actually 2013, the Oil and Gas Competitive Review Board, and I found it on page one in the red book. Mm-hmm. Was that SB 21? Was that correlated? Do you know? Or if not, we can look into it.
I can check really quickly.
It was SB 26, I think. It was done earlier, wasn't it?
It was Senate Bill 21 through the chair. Sorry, right, Senator Reinbold. It was Senate Bill 21.
Thank you.
I think it was Senator McGuire that put that in, if I remember correctly.
Continuing on, in 2016, there was a provision to repeal on July 1st, 2020, Alaska Statute 14.07.175, which relates to the development of a statewide assessment plan and review of education laws and regulations. Next, in 2018, various statutes relating to education tax credits were provided that were scheduled to be amended on January 1st, 2021 to change the amount of the credits to 50% of contributions of cash and equipment accepted for certain educational purposes. So there's a variety of these education tax education credits, and they had a previously had a different computation for the contributions, but after January 1st, 2021, it'll be 50% of the contributions. There are two different session laws from 2019 that will be fresh in everyone's mind. The first one was from Senate Bill 44 relating to prescription drugs. And this bill has several provisions that amend statutes on March 1st, 2020, so coming up, to allow physician assistants to diagnose a patient and prescribe medication to a patient without conducting a physical examination under certain circumstances. So this is authority that was passed a few years ago for physicians, but last year it was added in for physician assistants as well. And that will take effect again March 1st, 2020. So finally is House Bill 49 from last year. Relating to crimes and criminal procedure. This bill amends and enacts certain statutes on January 1st, 2020, so it's passed, but it's, recent, relating to sexual assault examination kits. It amends and enacts statutes on July 1st, 2020, relating to tracking and reporting data on felony sex offenses, and it amends a statute on September 1st, 2020, relating to a person's duty to report harm to a child if the harm appears to be a result of a sex offense.
And I think there were regulation packages that needed to follow through on some of those, but that's the implementation dates.
Mm-hmm.
Questions? There are several things in here, I think, that will pique the interest of the Senate Judiciary Committee. So last comments, Megan?
For the record, Megan Wallace, Director of Legal Services. I just note, as I pointed out in your packets, if you found today's presentation extremely enlightening, we have prior copies of our oversight report on the intranet, so I encourage you to go back and take a look. If there's something not on that list, contact my office. We have all our historical copies of the oversight report. And I will also note that in addition to the oversight report, each year after the end of session, we also compile a summary of legislation, which summarizes all the bills that have passed the legislature that last session. And so those are also available on our intranet. And to the extent that you don't get copies of those interim reports, please don't hesitate to contact my office, and we'll be happy to deliver you a report or point you to where you can get an electronic copy.
Senator Shelley Hughes.
Yes, thank you, Chair John Coghill.
I was going to say Shelley, and then I thought, oh, no, I better be more professional.
If I were to go back and look at the 2016, 2017, 2018, they are as they were presented at that time. Have you ever thought, and I don't know how much work it would be, but if I were to pull up 2017, it'd be really nice to know if the legislature did take any of the recommendations and fix any of those things. Has there ever been any thought, and I don't know how involved that would be, but if we were going to look at one of these from the past year or two, I'd be really curious if some of these things were addressed, or we just have to call you up and go through them one by one. I mean, especially when I think of the three attorneys that worked hard on this at the end of this session, it seems like it'd be pretty easy for them to go through this report and say, SB such and such addressed this and did this. Would that be something doable, or would that be very onerous for you?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, it's not something we currently track. The legislature could certainly add that to our list of responsibilities under the statute that requires us to prepare the report. I don't discount the utility of something like that, but it's not something that we currently have built into our process. We might consider, an informal tracking mechanism like that. But the information you're asking about is pretty easily ascertainable from one of us. So if you go back through that report and you want to know if the legislature's introduced a bill, relating to that statute, we can usually put our fingers on that pretty quickly with the way with our databases and basis and things like that.
So one of the reasons why I wanted the committee to go through this verbally is there's something about having it said to you over against having it read to you, mm-hmm. and or reading it yourself. And I think Senator Reinbold's reaction to the first couple of court cases is why we should do this, is because how the courts hear what we say and how we mean what we say has some pretty significant effect, even to the point of how to divide up a checkbook between joint owners and a creditor, right? So it's just important that we hear these things. And so I sat down and read the report, but I can tell you what I heard today and what I read, you know, because I started daydreaming halfway through the report, you know. So this kept us on track. So I'm grateful. And yes, I think it's good for us to review these regularly for that very reason. There are things that get by us. But it's our responsibility, though, to keep track of them. And I'm reluctant to give any more responsibility to a group of people that we really put through the ringer during probably at least two-thirds of the year. mm-hmm. So one-third, they get to sit back and make reports like this. So, well, with that, thank you for the report, and thank you for the questions. I think it was very engaging, and obviously there's work to do. And whether it's an effective date issue or how do we answer a court case or how – it's interesting. As we make laws, we do things – we have to make a consensus or agreements or compromises, which necessarily ends up in some ambiguity that the courts end up finally having to figure out. If the less we can do that, the better. It's just a fact. And then we can't think of every circumstance, like you said – to have a wife do one thing and have the court take the rule of law and apply that, and the incongruity to us is hard for us to get to. But we can't think of everything, and so once again, that brings it to light. I find it interesting, and we'll try to stay on top of it. I thank you for all your work and for this report. I think what you've done is stirred a few notions here. And I think that's the important part of this whole thing is how do we respond to the way our law is handled and the way we move it forward. Thank you very much, committee members. At this point, I'm going to say our I'm not going to announce our next meeting because we will have the Senate Bill 55 before us as soon as I can get it. We moved it from Rules Committee to the Judiciary. The issue is the Court of Appeals and their need for judges. And Senator Wilson said that he has a modification that he would like to bring before the committee. We'll have, as soon as I can get it drafted up, we'll have a CS before us and show you the changes from the original to the draft and then try to dispatch that as quickly as we can. I know the courts are looking for it. I think it's a good idea. You heard the Supreme Court Justice the other day call for it. And I think the senator came up with a better way to move it. So we'll consider that before us as soon as I get it, all right? But with that, we'll adjourn this meeting at, looks like, 2:50.